Welcome to the Punk Rock MBA Podcast.
Hello, everybody. I am Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock MBA Podcast. Today's guest is Patrick H. Willems. He is a YouTuber that does a channel by the same name. And I don't know, I guess you could essentially think of it as the same kind of thing I do, only about movies instead of music. I discovered his channel, I think, around late 2016, maybe early 2017, and he was one of the biggest inspirations behind my whole channel, and if you watch his videos, you'll see why. Very similar kind of format. I'm a big fan of his content, but I'm also a big fan of him from a business perspective. Like we talk about in this interview, he has a ridiculously large number of patrons for a channel his size. And that enables him to be a lot more free from worrying about the YouTube algorithm than a lot of people, like, for example, than me. And just in general, I admire anybody that's able to make a living on YouTube without resorting to all the kind of stuff that we know works, the negative crap and the drama and talking shit and all that stuff. He doesn't do any of that stuff, and yet he has still managed to build a super successful channel for himself. It became his full-time job about 2 years ago or something like that. So I wanted to sit down with him and, as always, do my best to figure out how he did it so you can do it too. If you are interested in supporting the show, there's a few things you can do if you are so inclined. Always appreciated but never expected. Number one is you can share it on social media. The podcast platforms don't do a great job of surfacing the show, so if you share it, then that really helps us a lot. Second, you can support us on Patreon if you really, really, really love us. It is actually because of the support of patrons that were able to do the show at all. That is how I was able to hire Deanna Chapman, the producer and editor, who is the brains behind this thing that makes it all go. There's no way that I could do this on my own. And it is because of the patrons that I'm able to pay her to do this. Patrons get every show a week early. There's a members-only private Discord server. There's a way to have me review your music or video, or anything else that you might want to get my eyes on. So if that sounds interesting to you, you can hit the link to that in the show notes. And with that out of the way, let's get into the episode. Patrick, welcome to the podcast. This is where I put on my podcast voice.
Awesome. I don't know if I have a podcast voice.
We both have voices made for podcasting.
Probably. It is a thing that I've noticed. I wouldn't say this is a podcast voice, but if I even go back and watch like videos I made, I don't know, 3 years ago, the way I speak on camera has changed completely. It's without me like really being aware of it at the time, it's just evolved. And I'm sure that goes for pretty much everybody. It's like a weird thing to realize.
Changed in what way?
I guess it's become more like television personality-y. It's like if I go back and watch things I made, it like especially when I was just like talking to the camera in like 2016, I just sound so sleepy and I don't enunciate enough, and it just seems kind of lifeless. And I guess the more you do it, the more you kind of like develop this on camera persona.
It's so true. And one of the things I was going to kind of tell you is that your videos now, I'd have to go back and watch some of the old ones, but the stuff you do now really does remind me of a cable TV show that I would have watched when I was a kid, in a great way, you know?
Thank you.
Because that's sort of what YouTube has become now, as opposed to, you know, when it was just short, stupid cat videos years ago or teenagers being zany. Now it's kind of like cable TV. It's like public access.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone follows me on Twitter, they know I have a lot of stupidly strong feelings about like terminology for what we call things we make on the internet and stuff like that. And I've just started, I think probably like this year, just kind of referring to my channel and as a show. And my videos as episodes, especially because like they're now like serialized and there's like a running narrative stuff. But I'm just like, look, these are about like half an hour each. Like each time, it's not like I'm just, you know, daily just like dropping a variety of little videos. It's like it's basically
it's a
show. Yeah. And so that's kind of how I look at it now.
Well, I want to get into all that, but first, for anybody who's not familiar, and actually for me, I don't actually know how you got into this in the first place. And I have watched almost all your videos, I think, and I'm sure you've mentioned this, and somehow I just missed it.
I can tell the short version of this. So
yes,
I graduated from college in 2010. Oh my God, it's been 10 years.
11, almost.
Don't say that. Like 10 is enough for me to grapple with. But so I graduated with a degree in cinema studies. I wanted to make movies and all that kind of thing. And there are no jobs waiting for you when you have a degree in cinema studies. No one is hiring directors. So I just moved home, worked retail for a year, and kind of like strategized about like, okay, what can be my next move?
And where is home?
Home is upstate New York, and I'm not like Westchester. That's not really upstate. I mean, like Saratoga Springs, New York, 4 hours north of the city where I currently live. And I should have done this years earlier, but this was the time that I finally started like looking at YouTube and realizing like, oh, people are doing like filmmaking stuff on there and like making careers for themselves and like getting like way more like way more people are watching the stuff they're making than if they than it, the traditional route of like making a short film and submitting it to festivals. And so so then in 2011, I launched the YouTube channel, and then simultaneously I started like doing freelance video work, which was my day job for like 5.5, 6 years until YouTube finally became profitable. But that was basically it. It was I felt like the two real options I had for how to like make some kind of filmmaking career were either move to LA and be like a PA and not actually make any of my own stuff, but like sort of like work in quotes the industry
with the hopes that some gatekeeper will sprinkle the magic fairy dust of success on you.
Exactly. Like maybe one day I'll get the right person coffee and they'll look at my script. And to be clear, so many people are more successful than me who have done it that route. So there's nothing wrong with that route. But my main thing was I wanted to be making stuff. That was always my thing. I would come home from college on like breaks and I'd get my friends together and we'd just make movies. I just wanted to be making stuff. So I decided I would start a YouTube channel and make like short films and stuff like that. And hopefully people would see them and maybe it would like lead to like career opportunities. And that was really it. It was, and then the YouTube channel, it was all narrative filmmaking stuff for 5.5 years. I didn't make a video essay until November 2016. And that was really it. It was just, I was just like using YouTube as a way to be able to produce a lot of stuff independently, like whatever I wanted. And then, and hopefully that stuff might reach some kind of audience.
What was the first time that you had that feeling of like, oh shit, this might actually work?
I will say I got really lucky. Not that this like made any money, but the third video I made in 2011, I started June 2011. I was doing like weekly videos for a while. I think until like for about a year until like the schedule got a bit fuzzier. But the third video I made, it was called Film Students Getting Punched. It was basically just kind of a montage of like film students saying various like, you know, like comically pretentious, insufferable film student things. Most of them were like direct quotes that I had like written down. I heard people say them when I was like in college. And then this girl played by my friend Chloe just goes around and like punches them all in the face. And that was the third video we made. And it got picked up by some websites. I remember like my sister rushing into my bedroom in the morning going like, Patrick, you're on the Huffington Post, which was like at the time.
Sure.
That seemed like a big deal. The video got like 40,000 views. It was not like super viral. But when before that, anything I'd made had been seen by at most like 1 to 200, 40,000 is huge.
Sure.
And so that was immediately the sign. Like I'm like, because like all of my friends were in that video because we needed a lot of people for it. And so we were all like talking about like, oh my God, like have you seen the comments? People are like, did you see what this person said about that person? And like suddenly we were like freaking out because it was evidence that this could potentially work.
And then what about, you know, as far as turning it into your full-time job?
That was a long road. Because like I said, I did not make a video essay for 5.5 years. And so basically for that 5.5 years, the channel did not make money. I lost money making those videos because I would spend money on them. And the thing about it was every so often there would be like an individual video that would like do well. Like to date, the most successful thing I've ever made was, came out in March 2015. It was the What If Wes Anderson Directed X-Men. And like that video, it went viral, got a lot of press. I got a copyright claim on it for a song that I used in it. So I didn't even make money off of that video.
My most popular video is a copyright claim too.
Yep. It was like, it was a thing. I was kind of expecting it because I used like a couple pop songs in it, but I was like, I think this video, it's better. It's so much better with these songs in it that it's worth getting demonetized just like for the quality of the work.
For the audience building and yeah.
Yeah. And so something like that, like, because my goal was never to make a living off of YouTube. My goal was to use YouTube pretty much the way people use Vimeo as like just like a portfolio. Like I'll make a thing, it'll get attention, then I'll get hired to go do other stuff.
Someone's going to say, I loved your YouTube short. Would you please direct my upcoming film about such and such?
Exactly.
That probably happens. I don't actually know that much about film, but I would imagine that probably does happen.
Well, this was the thing. Like, the Wes Anderson X-Men video, suddenly that did well, and I was immediately, like, I had all these meetings with, like, production companies and producers and stuff like that, and I really thought, like, it was all happening in 2015. Like, suddenly, like, I think I've talked about this in other places. I spent a lot of that year developing basically a spin-off series of that video with Vanity Fair. They paid me to write a couple scripts for it, and then various things happened behind the scenes there, and like the plug got pulled. But that was after spending like 7 months like developing the stuff. But like that's really what I was going for.
See, this is why I don't like the move to LA and schmooze with people model, because you're not in control.
Right.
All it takes is one of those, you know, someone changing their mind or a budget shifting or someone getting, you know, fired, and then your project goes away through no fault of your own. And there's just too many, it's like a house of cards. And if any one of those cards falls, then, you know, you get left in the cold.
That's exactly it. And like the people at those companies, they have like salary jobs. Like they still keep on working. And then I'm just sitting here like alone in my apartment being like,
what happened? The rug got pulled out from under me.
Yeah, I'm back at square one, and now they won't return my emails anymore, and I have to figure out something else. And so, like, it was like that. Like, that was the biggest, like, almost opportunity where it really seemed like stuff was going to happen. But that was the kind of thing I was always going for. Like make a thing on YouTube that will get attention, that will then lead to other jobs. And it was pretty much a fluke that it was, like, fall 2016. I didn't have any ideas that were as good as the Wes Anderson X-Men. I was like, I don't know what to do now. And so I just took a couple months off from making YouTube videos. And I just started like watching other stuff on YouTube. And I decided to basically have like one, to give it one last shot, but to approach my strategy a little bit differently, because like what I had been doing was I'd make one video every 3 or 4 weeks. There was no set schedule. Each one was a giant production where it's like trying to make some like big high concept like viral video. And I was like, what if I don't do that? What if I take like 3 months and just make weekly videos where a video will come out every Wednesday and go for a consistency, which I hadn't been doing. And I realized that, like, if I'm going to do that, I can't make a short film every single week. I'll have to try different kinds of videos. And so I was like, some that, like, maybe some I can just make on my own. Maybe some where I, like, talk about movies. And 2016, talking to other people I know, like, other, like, video essayist friends of mine, that seems like it was a year that, like video essays really started, like, becoming a bigger thing. And I was like, look, I have a degree in cinema studies. I've written essays about film. I can probably do one of those. And for like 4 years, I had just been ranting to all my friends about my problems with the color grading in Marvel's movies. And I was like, great, I've already said this thing so many times. I'll just...
Oh, was that your first video essay?
Yeah.
Remind me the title of that one.
The title is Why Do Marvel's Movies Look Kind of Ugly? And so I really just like, again, I'd been prepping for that video for like 4 years.
Which is a fantastic title in hindsight. I don't know if you went into it knowing that, but... You know, knowing, and I want to talk about titles, but thinking about it now, I'm like, well, I'm not surprised that that was such a successful video.
Here's the funny thing about that. So I had made that video, and are you familiar with a thing that YouTube does called Next Up?
I mean, there, I know the feature, you know, in the player.
Okay, yeah, that's probably what they got it from. Or maybe, I mean, I don't know which came first, but Next Up is a program that they... I don't know if they still do it, but they did it for several years where it's like they basically, you apply to it.
Oh, okay. I don't know about this.
Okay. It's like a program where I think they do one at each of the YouTube spaces, like around the world. So like New York, LA, London, stuff like that. But they do it like maybe like once a year and you apply to it and you have to have, I think, like less than 100,000 subscribers. And they pick 15 people that I guess they deem like, have potential to like be successful on the platform, and they bring you to like for this all expenses paid trip where you basically spend a week like being trained in like just YouTube video making. You get to like you're like put up in a hotel and stuff like that. And I mean, when I did it in 2016, I was the only local New Yorker, but I was like, I'm still going to take the free
sure,
hotel,
why not?
Even though I already live in the city. Yeah, but so it's all this cool stuff. But then they like, you have these like workshops about like titles and thumbnails and planning like long-term like strategy for the channel and stuff like that. You like,
so it's like those creator studio videos, but like a in-person workshop kind of thing.
Exactly. And they're working with you one-on-one. There's like guests there and stuff like that. Then they like, it's a cool thing. And I'm very lucky that I got in, because you have to like, it's like when you apply, it's like you have to have released just so many videos and like at least three videos in the last 90 days. And I just barely made that because my output was so slow back then. But anyway, I got in, and it just happened that I like finished that video like right before the week started, and so I already had it ready to publish like the middle of the week when I was at Next Up. And I think the day before, we'd had a workshop about titles and thumbnails, and about like, oh, it's good, you know, like having a question in the title is like that's like the thing people respond to. And I was just gonna call the video Marvel's Color Grading, and then it was like, it was so lucky that it was like right in the middle of this, and I had just had this workshop, and I was like, maybe I should give that a catchier title and do what they told me to do. And so then I just like changed my thumbnail, so it was like this big, like attention grabbing kind of clickbaity thing. And then the video, and like, here to make the rest of this very long story short, the video did really well. I thought no one would watch it because it was a boring technical video about color grading, which I thought no one gave a shit about. I was wrong. It did really well. To put this in perspective, it'd take me 5.5 years to get to 18,000 subscribers. That's where I was at the time. I think within like a couple weeks, that number had doubled. And so suddenly that started doing really well. And I realized, oh, I should make more of these. Like my mistake that I'd made in 2015 was when the Wes Anderson X-Men video blew up. I first did not make another video for a month after that. I just like chilled out and did nothing. And then I didn't make another video like that, like in that series, the What If So-and-So Directed This. I didn't make one of those for like 4 more months. When looking back at it now, it's like, oh, I should have had another one ready to go
right
immediately to build off of the success of that and have like some momentum. That's why that like, the Wes Anderson X-Men did well, but it didn't lead to like any growth for like the channel. And this time I realized, okay, I can't make that mistake again. I need to start making more video essays. And at first it became like, I'll make one video essay a month. And then it became more and more and more until it just became the whole channel. The Marvel color grading one, it made like, that actually generated like AdSense revenue. Like that made money. And then It was like I didn't have like a sponsor on the channel until like 9 months after that, but it's still like AdSense actually started becoming like kind of real money. So it took a full like 6 years pretty much for the channel to actually become profitable. And then it was about, I would say, like spring 2018 that it kind of became my full-time job.
Wow. Okay. That recently.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I think, because I was still doing like freelance video work alongside this as like my main source of income. And then I think like, especially for what had been my main client, the last project I did with them was like June 2018. And that's when I was like, I think I need to like, I just need to like YouTube is like doing well enough and generating enough income that I...
The opportunity cost is too high.
Exactly. And it's not worth the time that I have to like put into like the freelance stuff. So that was pretty much when I stopped with it. So yeah, it's like a relatively recent thing, and it took many, many years to work.
So one thing that I am really impressed by is that you have a lot of patrons. Like, you're up to what, 1400 or something now?
I think like 1500. Well, yeah, we had a goal that was at 1500 and we hit that. Okay. So we're there.
By comparison, I have 300 and our channels have roughly the same number of subscribers. So you have done an amazing job of building this community. And like, I mean, that is a shocking number of patrons for a channel your size. So I wonder, what do you think is the key to getting that much support from people to the extent that they want to be your patrons?
That's a really good question, because what you raised there, the sort of like, you know, comparison point about like size of audience to like size of Patreon, like it's funny, like I've seen channels that have like smaller, like fewer subscribers than me, but with then like more patrons than me. And so, I'll look at this being like, what am I doing wrong? Like how does this work? And to be fair, my Patreon is so simple. It's like, there's like no rewards pretty much. Like I used to mail out physical rewards and it just became like too much to keep up with.
I don't think people care about the rewards on Patreon. I think they just want to support you.
They don't. That's really the thing. I don't even have time. Like, I wish I could give people early access to videos, but since I'm always behind schedule.
Can I have it like 2 hours early?
yeah, exactly. It's I can't even keep up with that, but I'm not an expert on this at all. I do think part of it comes down to like, you know, I guess like just like personal investment or like some sort of like relationship there. A thing that, and I'm sure people can point me to evidence that like contradicts this, but like I'll see in general, it seems like, and if we're just talking YouTube channels where the person is on camera seem to do better on Patreon than channels where the person is not on camera. And it's just like the voiceover. And so I think like the more the personality and like the more open a person seems, the more it's like, this is me. I like, it's my name. I am a person here doing this.
Cause people want to support. I mean, that's why it's called Patreon, just like the old patron model where rich people would support artists. You know, the entire intent of the platform is to support individual humans doing something that you like. And so the more that you put yourself out there as a human and help people get to know you, I think it can be the littlest things. Like maybe somebody is also from Saratoga Springs and they're like, you know what? Fuck it. I'll give this guy $5 a month.
I think that's totally right. And also one thing that I've noticed is that when it comes to Patreon, some people can notice it's like I think the more like elaborate and like high production value my videos became, that also seemed to lead to just like the Patreon like ticking up. I think it's like part of that is just like the audience looking at it and seeing like, oh, it seems like our support is actually being put right to use. It's like, I can see those dollars on screen now. Like he's not just using this to like get a cushy apartment and like buy himself nice clothing.
I think that's so weird when I see people flexing like that who also have a Patreon. I mean, you know, I'm not going to tell everyone what they should or shouldn't do, but just to me personally, if I was a patron, I'd be like, this guy doesn't need my money.
Right. Yeah, I never know. Like, here's my theory about, or like my philosophy about Patreon. And this is part of why, like, my highest tier is $4. I don't need anyone to pledge like $30 a month. The way I look at it is, I think everyone who enjoys something should just chip in $1 a month, because that, like, that's what I don't want to sound like a cheapskate here, but like most of the Patreons that I support, I toss in like whatever like the sure. lowest tier is, just like a buck or two, because I think that's all it really requires and that's all it takes. And it's like, because a dollar is nothing. Like, you'll never sure. miss a dollar. You can drop it and never realize.
Anybody.
Right. And if everybody did that, obviously with YouTube, not every subscriber watches every video, but like, if you even just took the people who like regularly like watch each video and just like, and they each gave $1 a month, that adds up to like an enormous amount. And so like, that's kind of the way I look at it. I'm like, that's all I ask of anybody. That's what I do myself. I think that's like the best way to make this system work.
I wonder though, so you have a lot of patrons, but because your pledges are so small, it's not enough for you to have total escape velocity from the algorithm. In other words, if, you know, if each of those patrons are paying you $10 a month, you don't give a shit what happens on YouTube. So right. I wonder, have you considered that about like potentially raising the pledges so that you could have more freedom and not have to do all the stuff that we all hate doing, like, you know, making videos with negative titles just because we know it pleases the algorithm?
Honestly, not really. The thing is, I feel like I actually do have a pretty solid like degree of freedom on YouTube. I mean, if you look at like the videos I have made in 2020, there are not a lot of...
You were not playing to the algorithm on most of those.
Yeah, I'm really not. It's about like every 6 months, maybe, I tackle like what I consider one of the core popular topics.
Marvel, Star Wars, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But then I also, because I love nothing more than to shoot myself in the foot and make life more difficult for myself, I will make a Star Wars video and then declare this is the last Star Wars video I will ever make. So I do stuff like that. But I mean, the way it is right now, like with between, you know, my income is split pretty solidly between the Patreon and the sponsors on
right.
That are on every video. And what I've noticed is, even if, like, I'm in a funny position that's where my audience is, for the past like 2 years, has been growing very slowly. In the YouTube creator dashboard, it tells you like how many subscribers you've gained in the last 30 days. Like, to like be totally transparent about this, I gained like 1,000 subscribers in the last 30 days.
Which to a lot of people listening might sound like that's amazing. And if you're just starting out, it is. But if you have 300,000 subscribers like you do, 1,000 a month is a little slow.
It is. And for the past 2 years, it has generally averaged between 1,000 and 3,000 a month. To put this in perspective, my best month ever was June 2017, where I gained 25,000 subscribers in 1 month. And so, yeah, so it's growing very slowly. There are not a lot of new people coming in, but it seems like the audience that's there is very invested and loyal, and like, they care enough that, I mean, all my interactions with the audience are pretty much always, like, I don't read the comments section, but like, my interactions with them, whether it's like on Patreon, on Twitter or anything like that, whenever I meet people in real life, back when we could meet people in real life, like, they're all like, they're a really like nice, chill, like open-minded group of people, and it seems like a lot of them at this point are willing to go with me to pretty much whatever topic I want to explore, and they're not only there to hear me talk about like the stuff that they already know really well.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like, you know, people request for me to make certain kinds of videos, and I'm like, you know, it sounds like you just want me to make a video telling you facts and trivia that you already knew.
That's exactly it.
And then sometimes I'm like, why am I so fucking stupid that I don't just make the fucking video?
Yep. These are things that I think about a lot. I think, especially when it comes to like film YouTube or like media criticism YouTube, what the majority of viewers want from that place. And I think it's funny because I think it's different on YouTube in like more traditional, like written like criticism. But what people seem to want is for this person on YouTube to basically just articulate exactly the opinion that they already have. Pretty much then they like, I guess, have evidence for arguments and can just send the video to places like to their friends that they disagree right. with to be like, no, here is proof that I am right.
The guy on YouTube said so.
Right. Because it's the weird thing that it's like I run into this, like I see people do this with me and I don't see it happen to like traditional film critics who write like who write like written reviews on like various like media publications, but
it's because they don't have an interactive audience, and like it's got to be old people, and like your audience is probably 10 times bigger than even big film critics.
I'm not even sure, but like the thing that I see happen is people will hold one single opinion that you once had against you forever. It'll be like, you liked this movie and therefore
you're not allowed to like this other movie 3 years later.
Right. That's it. Or it's like, why would I give a shit about what you say about right. anything? Because you once said this thing about this. It's like, it's this weird thing where it's like, again, this is not really my audience, but a lot of people, a lot of the YouTube audience, they seem to like specifically want like channels that voice that share the exact same opinions
on everything
as them. Yeah, and my thing, and I think like what's cool about the audience that I've built and what they seem to be into is just experiencing different perspectives and maybe hearing about movies that they haven't seen before, or maybe hearing a take on a movie that like they may have dismissed but find out about like why maybe it's actually worth considering and stuff like that. And that's what I'm interested in as well. But a lot of like YouTube like film and media audience does not really feel that way.
They just want confirmation of their existing opinions.
Exactly.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan. And this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King in Off-Road Minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services. DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
You have an interesting sort of place, I think, which is what similar to where I try to be, of you're not, snooty and, you know, overly navel-gazing. You know, you look down your nose at anything popular. On the other hand, you're not a fanboy where, you know, you just gush over whatever the latest thing is because you like the franchise. You have a nice sort of middle ground where you're able to look critically at these things and evaluate them, you know, based on what they're trying to achieve. And you may or may not like it, but you're able to, I think, have an informed, sophisticated take on things like Michael Bay without falling into either the hater or fanboy sort of trap. And, you know, for sure, you would have a bigger channel if you just made videos like top 10 reasons why Transformers is total garbage and you're a piece of shit human if you like it.
Yep.
But you have, you know, just like I've chosen not to make similar videos. You have too. And I would rather have that smaller but like decent audience than cater to like the worst of humanity.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's also a thing where I think if you make those types of videos, it's all like, you know, obviously, like, we love seeing numbers go up. There's something just like that will always be satisfying about that. But I do think, I mean, actually, this probably isn't the case for a lot of people make those videos and are very successful. So maybe they don't feel this way. But I feel like I would eventually like feel this like emptiness sink in, where it's like, because like my rule about what I make is I only make videos that I'm excited about. I only cover topics that I'm passionate about and that I really feel like I have something to say there. And so, and that's like when I, you know, earlier this year was like, I'm not going to make a Star Wars video again. Part of that was because I was like, I think I put everything I have to say, like in here, and there's no, and like, sure, it's a topic that gets views, but I don't really, like, unless something really radical happens in the Star Wars franchise in the next year or so, I don't anticipate having anything really worthwhile to add to what I've already said. And so I'm just not gonna, you know, force it. And I feel like my audience would realize if I was just like transparently making a video because it's like, oh, it's like a topical thing and people want to hear me say something about it. But it's like, like a lot of them, I don't have anything to say about it.
I feel exactly the same way. And I actually did phone a video in once. It was in March or something of this year, I think. I had a really bad previous month and I was like, shit, I need to do something to like pull this out of the gutter. And I made a video about Pantera, which I like Pantera, but I didn't have anything to say about them. So I pretty much just summed up a bunch of facts that everybody already knew. And it was a very popular video. It did great.
Of course.
But it didn't feel good. It really didn't. And you know, I always wrestle with myself on that. And I guess, look, we're not working in the coal mines here. I'm not trying to say poor me, but
we're in very fortunate positions.
Yes. So I want to always be cognizant of that and be very grateful for where we are. But I do always wrestle with that of like, you know, I feel like people just want me to make stuff. I feel like I would be rewarded for phoning it in, which doesn't feel good. And I don't have a good resolution for that.
Yeah. Well, a thing that I also wonder about, like, you know, if we did phone in those videos and do the stuff on like the big popular topics and make them like easy to digest, didn't say anything too controversial. But I also wonder like how devoted the audience would be. Would they actually like a thing that I was talking with some other creators about this recently. So I had never really looked at this, but we were having a conversation just like comparing our in our analytics, there is like percentage of audience that is subscribed.
Yeah.
And apparently mine is like abnormally high.
Do you know what the number is?
It's like 63.
Yeah, it's super high. I think mine is like 40 something. And I think even that is higher than average.
That is high. Yeah. A lot of people have like 20%. That's normal. Where, you know, people find the videos just because they're like recommended, but they don't subscribe. And so like, and that's normal for YouTube.
I care about watch time a lot too. Like my watch time is around 60%, which is super, super good. And that's something I'm very proud of. That means that of the people who watched, they actually thought that something I had to say was worth sticking around for 12 fucking minutes, which is an eternity on YouTube.
Right. Yeah. No, same here. And realizing that like, okay, most of my audience are people who are subscribed, who are like familiar with the channel. Like, I think, you know, if I made those videos, they would just be less invested.
That's
true. They would tell that I'm less invested. The views would come, but they would come from a different source. And again, it's a thing I think about constantly. About like every couple months, I'll have one day where I'll just panic and just be like just like flooded with like self-doubt, and I'll be like, am I making all the wrong decisions? Am I doing like, am I approaching YouTube entirely wrong? Am I just like squandering this potential to have a much bigger audience? Am I like, why am I doing this? And then I'll like, you know, post a bunch of tweets about it, because I just use like Twitter as like a, you know, a therapist who doesn't really reply. and then like the next day I'll be like, wait, no, everything is fine. Everything is okay. It's I'm like making a good living, and I have a really, really good, like devoted audience who will be there when I talk about like whatever non-commercial shit I want to talk about. And that's really cool. And so would I love it to like to have like an audience twice as big? Sure. But also like I don't, like it's not like things are like desperate. Sure. Where I have to, there's nothing to fix.
I mean, you're regularly getting, you know, high five figures or low six figures on anything you publish, which is an amazing place to be. I mean, to know that you can put out anything and at minimum 50,000 people will see that in a couple weeks is amazing.
Yeah, it's really pretty good. And I have no reason to like to change anything. I think.
And by the way, I have that same conversation with myself almost every day. So,
okay.
Rather than every couple months, I do it almost every day. So you're ahead of me on that.
I mean, to be fair, I think it's probably because I only publish like two videos a month. So it's like it's kind of a cycle that comes. It's like a slower cycle.
Right, right.
And the thing about this is exactly what YouTube wants us to think. Mm-hmm. Because look, when you open the creator dashboard, the first thing you look at is YouTube telling you how your most recent video is is performing compared to your previous nine videos. Yep. And when you have like, look, I can tell you, like, my latest video, it was, for a little while, it was in 10th position out of the last 10.
So was mine, and I felt horrible.
Yeah, it sucks. Mine has now moved up to number 7, which I'm like, okay, that's better. But, like, especially because my latest video, it was a part 1 video, so I'm, like, working on the follow-up to what is already, like, my worst performing video in, like, you know, I don't know, several months, knowing for a fact that part two videos never do as well as the part one video. And so I'm just like, shit, this, have I just made giant miscalculations? And then it was also the weird thing about like knowing that the entire reason that I'm making this video, which is now a two-part video, is because of a Patreon goal that we hit. And so like, this is not even a video that I like thought up myself. This is a video that like the audience demanded with their dollars that I make. So it was a whole roller coaster of emotions. I'm feeling fine about it now.
You've heard every YouTuber in the world have conversations about this, about like how it's an emotional roller coaster. And there's a reason for that, because it is. And, you know, I would imagine it's kind of, you know, mostly I talk to bands and I think it's kind of similar for them, except they release an album every year or two and go through all this. And, you know, we do stuff every week or a couple weeks or whatever. And it's super real. I'm almost certain it's quite bad for our mental health, in the same way as, you know, being a roofer for 20 years is going to destroy your knees, but you just sort of shrug and accept like, well, you know, that's the cost of doing business.
I know. It's like making the comparison to bands is good, because like what I usually think of is just like, okay, if I'm obviously like my goal is still to like direct things that, you know, I don't pay for myself, like movies and stuff like I want to direct narrative cinema. Let's put it this way. But like, if you direct a movie, like especially if it's like a Hollywood film, and you've got an opening weekend, I mean, like in a normal world where people go to the movie theater, but like the pressure that you must feel, where it's like, okay, so basically this company entrusted me with like, I don't know, $40 million. And now, like, hopefully it makes that money back and makes a profit. And it pretty much comes down to this. I mean, pretty much within like the first day, like by like 5 p.m. on Friday, they know how it's going to do. And it's like, oh, if that loses the studio money, then I might not be able to work again.
Imagine being Christopher Nolan and it's like, hey, Chris, listen, no pressure, but the entire theater industry is riding on this.
Right. Yeah. I will say, like, the thing with Nolan also is apparently Warner Brothers wanted to push it back, but he was like, no, I'm going to save theaters.
All right. Well, in that case, I don't feel bad for him.
Yeah. But, like, you know, that, like, I've never been under that much pressure ever. I'm doing this thing on Francis Ford Coppola, a guy who straight up bought a movie studio and then bet all of it on one movie.
There's something poetic about the fact that that video is not doing well.
I know. Hey, maybe part two, which I'm not going to put the words part two in the title.
Yeah.
And I'm still figuring out exactly what the title will be, but I've got a couple ideas. But like, you know, the amount, like that amount of pressure of being like, okay, I have this one passion project, and then so like I will like be in so deep in debt, and so many people will just lose their jobs if this does not make money. And then not only does it not make money, it is like one of the most spectacular failures in the history of the industry. I've never gone through anything like that. I can't complain.
Yep. Yeah. Our little 10 out of 10 notification is peanuts compared to that.
Yeah, exactly. I will say, like, the thing that does seem appealing, at least about just, you know, the more structured, established, like doing this like in sort of industry way, is at least there you have like sort of a support group. For me here, it's like I'm just like alone in this apartment that I'm like making stuff in, and there isn't like, you know, like a whole like structured team where I'm like, you know, we're all in it together. It's like, right. No, it's just me. Like I can complain about this to my friends, but there isn't really like solidarity there.
Do you have any like good friends who are decent sized YouTubers?
Now, like watch them.
Like what? Like,
how could you say that about me? No, the thing is I have over the past couple years or so become friends with some YouTubers. But the thing is, we all live so far, like in like different countries or at least on like different coasts. And so a lot of us have never met in person. The ones that I have, I've maybe met them in person like once or twice. And so it's like, you know, we're like friends, but like we mostly just communicate on Twitter.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like I would not say none of my closest friends are YouTubers.
The reason I ask is because I have a couple of friends, one in particular, Brian from Rockfeed, who I collaborate with, or I guess use as a sounding board a lot. And it's super helpful because nobody other than a decent sized YouTuber can really give you that kind of feedback on titles and thumbnails and stuff, because they have that pattern recognition and it's super valuable. So for anybody out there who, you know, whether you're a YouTuber or anything else, like make friends with somebody who is like at a similar level as you are in whatever it is you do. Having that like sounding board, I don't know what I would do without it, because otherwise, like you said, it's just me and my wife sitting here, and God bless my wife. She gives me very good feedback, but you know, that's not her particular area of expertise. I don't know how anybody can do it. Like you just sitting there by yourself in a vacuum, like, well, here goes nothing.
I should say, like, I will sometimes like talk to other YouTubers. Like a lot of us have like a Slack that we're in. We'll like talk about stuff like that. And sometimes I'll be like, okay, I'm really stuck on this thumbnail. Can you give me some input on this? But like in general, like even so, to be clear, I don't want to say like oh, I don't work with anybody. I do everything myself. I do, like, as anyone who's seen my videos knows, there is a team there. There's a group of friends that I've been working with for since like before the YouTube channel started. But I, you know, who do like writing and acting and stuff like that. Literally in the past month. So the way it had always gone on the channel was when we were making just like purely narrative short films and stuff like that, and the channel made no money at all, we all worked together really closely and we would all like, you know, like work on scripts. We like, it was like a very much a team effort. And then when the essays started, that was just like my thing.
Right.
I just like did that all on my own. And then even I, you know, in the past couple of years, as like the sort of the essay is like gained this narrative component and became kind of like a blend of like essay and short film, I would still have get my friends to help on the videos, but only with like the narrative components. Because I was always like, that's the fun stuff. The essays, which are the part that like make money, that's like the hard work, boring part. I'll do all of that. About a month ago, the main core three friends of mine, Matt, Mike, and Jake, who, you know, I've always helped out, they've become a bit more like officially involved. They do get paid now. It's still pretty much for like the narrative stuff, but it is like a little bit more like they have a bit more responsibility now. They're more like it's a bit more of a team effort, and I hope this
thing.
Yeah, and I hope it can continue to grow and have them become more involved, because there's nothing I would love more than for this to get to the point where I can just like straight up like hire like my friends that I love working with. And pay them real money.
Well, it seems like you kind of got there. I mean, I don't know financially, but like during COVID. So for anybody listening who's not familiar with the channel, you were living in Brooklyn before, right?
I mean, I still am.
Oh, okay.
But like I got stuck at my parents' house for 5 months.
You retreated up upstate to your parents' house.
Can I be totally clear about something?
Yeah.
Because I felt very guilty not being in New York when it was really bad in New York. The reason I was at my parents' house for 5 months is that I just happened to visit in the middle of March to shoot a video up there. I was supposed to be there for 3 days, and then I happened to be there right when things started getting bad, and I was like,
I'm not going to go back.
It probably doesn't seem like traveling is a good idea. Maybe I'll stick around here for a little bit longer. And then what was supposed to be like staying until the end of the week became 5 months. But so, no disrespect to anyone who did, like, flee, because I totally get it, but I do want to make it clear, like...
You're not a fucking punk. Not a coward.
It was straight up like my weird timing, you know, with just scheduling a visit.
Well, with all of that being said, I think like for a lot of people, that ended up being kind of a forcing function for some, you know, creative change, and you sort of moved to more of this almost like talk show kind of format that to me kind of brings all the different stuff that you've done, you know, together into something that, you know, I feel like that was a real moment, like an inflection point for the channel creatively. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really nice way to put it. It was funny. Like a thing I became really fascinated by was just like during this period when we're all like in quarantine and stuff like that, just like looking at how people dealt with that in their creative work. And so, because what I realized right away was that, you know, I didn't know how long, I thought originally, like when I was there, I was like, maybe I'll be back in the city like in a couple weeks, and maybe this is going to blow over and we can get back to our regular plans.
It'll be over by the middle of April. That's what I said.
Yep. And then when it became clear that that was not going to happen, it just be like, I realized I had to keep making the videos. I had them scheduled already, and I had to find some way to work in this new place. And this is happening after like the videos already have this like narrative component, and like I'm a character in the videos, and so I'm like, how do we deal with this here? But also because my resources are limited, it's like I'm here in this house in like the woods. The only people here are my parents. You know, there's not a lot to work with. And then it was when I started seeing the way that all of these like late night talk show hosts were kind of pivoting to becoming YouTubers.
Really, really bad, like 2009 YouTubers.
Right. And I really enjoyed watching them try to like learn how to do this stuff and like film things like in their homes. And then you had the thing of like some celebrities like my arch nemesis, John Krasinski, just like starting YouTube shows. And so that kind of gave me the idea like, okay, we've got these like celebrities kind of like encroaching on our turf. What if I just tried to beat them at their own game and do a talk show, except make it better? And then what became like necessary with that is like, look, you know, because I'm like a talk show, I'm kind of limited to being like, I'm here at a desk in front of a backdrop, but like, I'd like the videos to have like some like variety to them and have more stuff going on. So I was like, what if we just like made segments? What if we really leaned into the talk show idea? What if we had an in-house band? What if we just had like cold opens and all this stuff? Like, what if we just took this format and then tried to like stretch it in as many ways as we could? And it ended up being this like really fun challenge that I think it lasted for exactly the right amount of time, because we did 10 episodes of it, and by the end of the 10, I was finally like, okay, I don't really have any more ideas for stuff we can do with this. Like, I think it's got to end soon. So, but also like we had to like plan far enough ahead, because, you know, when I would return to the city and like trying to figure out when that would be, like, we had to like be able to plan for like, okay, because the end of the talk show would have to involve me ending the talk show. And like, it's this weird thing where like my real life and my like fictional YouTube life have become like just like so blurred, like the line between them. It was really, really enjoyable and just like a really fun challenge. And what I loved about it was like, I am someone who has always been terrible at delegating. I am a control freak. And with this, just by the way we were shooting it, I had to relinquish some control, and my friends and collaborators would shoot stuff on their own and send me the footage to edit. And so I just had to, I would give them guidelines for like, here's a shot list, here's how I want you to frame the shots and stuff like that, be looking in this direction of the camera. But and then I just kind of sat back and I would get this footage like pouring into like my Google Drive, and I would look at it and be like, oh my God, this is so much better than I thought it would be. Like finally, like at this point in my life, I'm like, maybe it's good to like let other people do some stuff.
What an idea.
Give them like a longer leash to do their own thing. And so it worked out so well that was really like a moment where I was like, I want to like just get them like more like officially involved. And so, and not just like my friends helping me out, but actually sure. like a real part of the team.
Cool. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. I know you got a video to finish, so I will let you go. But is there anything you wanted to add or plug or any parting words of wisdom for the folks out there who might be listening?
Oh, man, that's a big question. I mean, the things to plug, it's what we've been talking about the whole time. The YouTube channel, Patrick H. Willems. It's there. It's easy to find. I'm the only Patrick H. Willems. You don't need to use the H. It's there in parentheses because like it's optional. The URL Patrick Willems was taken.
My dad spells his name J-O-N. He says you can keep the H.
Yes, that's a good. I might have to steal that. But like parting words of wisdom. I mean, look, if you're trying to get into the YouTube game. I realize we've spent a lot of time talking about how like we don't like doing what's popular and we don't like doing like what people.
And we sound like such assholes.
I know. But the one thing that I think is the most important, while like I hope everyone becomes successful, unless you are an asshole, and in which case I don't want you to be successful, is just like genuinely like make the videos that you would want to watch. If you can find a way to cover a popular thing in a way that you're excited about and feel strongly about, then do it. But I think the audience can tell the difference between making something because you think it'll get views and making something because you like really care about it and want to make it. And I think the latter is really matters. And look, doing that has given us careers here. So we're living proof that it works.
There you go. Cool. Well, thank you so much, and good luck with the rest of the video.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get into some Q&A. I love the entrepreneurial/marketing approach that you take to analyze topics in your videos. There are several channels on YouTube that do the same about music marketing or music production, and most of the time those channels are selling products such as online lessons. You don't sell anything for now. Do you plan to go one step further and create paid-for lessons about marketing? Do you plan to write a book or none of that because you're fine with sharing your time between YouTube and your other job? Well, never say never. I don't currently have any plans to do anything like that. I have done some marketing kind of courses before, but here's the thing. I have very high standards for this because I have spent the last 8 years or so of my life working in online education at Creative Live and now at URM Academy. So I have very, very high standards for this. I care a lot about it. And the thing I would never, ever want to do is just put out some kind of cheap, shitty course just to try to make a little bit of money. You've seen a lot of these, like in every time, like you buy it and you may like the person a lot, but you buy the course and then you log in and kind of like, oh, cool, let's see what this is all about. And it's like obvious that they didn't put very much effort into it, or maybe they did, but it's just not good. You know, if I'm going to do something like that, I want to make sure that I do it right. And one big part of that is that I would want it to be something that people who work in the industry respect. You know, there's nothing that bums me out more than thinking that, you know, what if I made something like this and people who work in marketing look at it and just kind of roll their eyes and they're like, what is this? The respect of my peers matters a lot. So again, it's just something that if I ever do it, I want to make sure that I do it well. As far as writing a book, yes, I would like to do that. The question that I would need to answer for myself and I guess for the world before I ever write a book is like, what will writing a book do for me that YouTube doesn't? Because, you know, if a book sold 10,000 copies, that would be really good. And obviously on YouTube or this podcast, I can get more than 10,000 people to listen to me talk about other stuff. So I don't need a book to grow my audience. So the question would be like, what will it actually accomplish? And the kind of working idea for a book that I have in my head would be some kind of a combination between 12 Rules for Life and Tools of Titans. But, you know, for people from the alternative music world scene, whatever. So Tools of Titans is a book where Tim Ferriss interviewed a couple hundred people or 100 people, something like that. These, like, you know, business leaders and athletes and just achievers of all kinds, and asked them a lot of questions about habits and routines. What do you eat for breakfast? Stuff like that, which I think his questions are kind of lame, but whatever. The point is, he asked them all a common set of questions so that you can read through all that and go, oh, looks like everyone gets up earlier. Whatever it is, the idea is that you would read that and learn something that you can apply to your own life. 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson, who I don't, just to be clear, I don't necessarily love everything he has to say, or I'm not a huge fan of him in general, but I do like the idea of the book. So if I was going to do a book, I think it would be something along those lines. It wouldn't be about music specifically. It'd be more about business and life and personal development for people from our world, I think. And so the question would be, like, so what? What for? Like, what would that do for me? And that's the question that I don't have an answer to yet. But if I can answer that question, then I will do it. But for now, yeah, I'm totally fine sharing time between YouTube and my other job. I have my hands more than full. From Polls Scene on Twitter, what's your workout routine? Well, first of all, I would not position myself as any sort of like expert in this stuff by any means. I mean, I definitely think that I know my way around a gym, and, you know, at one point I lost like 50 pounds in less than a year. So I definitely know what I'm doing here, but I'm not any sort of like authority on this stuff. I just know what works for me. I don't really give advice to other people on this. But with that said, what I've found works for me, I used to run and lift weights all the time, like, you know, 5 days a week for like an hour and a half or whatever. And that totally worked. That's how I lost a bunch of weight. I was also doing MMA then. So I was training real hard, like MMA 6 days a week, lifting several days a week on top of that, running. Like, you know, it's no wonder that the weight fell off real fast. I also learned how to eat then. And again, I'm not saying this is what everyone should do or shouldn't do or anything like that, but I learned how to eat then from a bunch of MMA fighters that were wrestlers. And, you know, one of the things that MMA fighters and wrestlers both have to do is manage their weight very carefully. So, you know, there's weight classes. You got to make sure that you never go over 155 or whatever, or the fight's off. So they're very good at managing their weight. I learned, you know, they're basically like, well, number one, you got to get over the idea of enjoying your food. So I ate a lot of like broccoli and chicken breasts and stuff like that. And fortunately, I don't really care about the taste of food, so that wasn't a big deal for me these days. And then after that, I stopped doing MMA and was just running and lifting for a while. And I enjoyed that. But now I fucking hate it. I still do it, but I just don't. I used to enjoy going to the gym and lifting and running and stuff, and I don't anymore. So mostly what I do now is jiu-jitsu. So, you know, with COVID, it's kind of been all over the place, but I try to go 4 days a week for 1 to 3 hours. And then I also do some running and lifting on top of that, depending on just kind of how things work out. But, you know, that's what works for me. I don't care about being some kind of like, you know, I'm not trying to be a fitness model, but I have been working out very consistently for about 20 years now, and I very rarely get sick. I never get injured. You know, if I go to the doctor, all my vitals are in a good spot. So that's what works for me. I think it's just, you know, like most things, it's just about consistency. All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.